On this week's special On Story, two critically and culturally acclaimed African-American directors, John Singleton and Charles Burnett. First, we look back at the work of the late John Singleton as he discusses his career and the creation of his first film, Boys in the Hood, which earned him the Best Director nomination at the Academy Awards and made him the first African-American nominee in that category that same year.
When you're making a film, it's like you're having a conversation with people. And if you do that very, very well, it will propagate in some way.
Later, Charles Burnett highlights details of his career development in narrative and documentary filmmaking with his seminal film, Killer of Sheep, a definitive representation of the African-American cultural experience.
If I had gotten in an argument with someone about, was this representative, you know, I would always point out the fact that I've seen this happen in the community. I got that from the community, these events, and I put them in a narrative to try to make sense out of them was the whole idea.
This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. John Singleton made his filmmaking debut in 1991 as the writer-director of the groundbreaking urban drama Boys in the Hood, which he wrote and directed. The film earned him Academy Award nominations for Best Original Screenplay and Best Director, the latter of which made him the youngest person as well as the first African-American to enjoy that distinction. Singleton's other films include Poetic Justice, Four Brothers, and the 2000s version of Shaft. John Singleton also co-created the FX Network crime drama Snowfall. Screenwriter Fred Stripe spoke with John Singleton at the 22nd Austin Film Festival in 2015, where he was awarded for his contributions to filmmaking.
I get a call last night from Aaron Halligan, who's running the conference and doing an awesome job, late last night. He goes, I think we've got John. And I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, we think we lost him. And I didn't know what it meant. But you had a hell of a time trying to get in here. And I guess you ended up in San Antonio, was it?
Yeah, I had a hard time getting out of L.A. Because, of course, you guys, there was floods and tornadoes, I guess, yesterday. So, yeah, it was a biblical force majeure kind of situation.
Tornadoes cannot stop John Singleton coming to Austin. So that's good. So I'm assuming everyone knows who John is, obviously, but I just wanted to mention a few things. He has a ridiculously lengthy list of awards and nominations and wins. One that I found really interesting was the African American Film Critics Association, the LA Film Critics Association, and the New York Film Critics Association all gave him their top honor within a year, I guess, when Boys in the Hood came out. And I don't think that's been done very often. MTV Movie Awards, Image Awards for his Four Brothers. It just goes on and on and on, including two Academy Award nominations that I'm sure you're aware of, John, being the first African-American and the youngest person to be nominated for the Oscar for Outstanding Achievement in Directing. So, look, I know you've told your story a million times because I've read it in a lot of different interviews and everything, but you are a storyteller. And for those, I think actually how you got started, you're at USC, you've got a few friends, but you're feeling maybe somewhat alienated. That story, I think, has resonance right now. So if you could just give us the thumbnail of what that was all like.
My story started way before USC. My story started when I grew up in Inglewood in an area called the Bottoms, which was all these apartment buildings that have now mostly been torn away. And a block over, there was a place called the Century Drive-In. So I grew up on the backside of a drive-in. I used to watch movies with no sound on them. And they weren't like The Godfather. They weren't great movies. They were like blaxploitation movies, Superfly and Pam Grier, Foxy Brown, Bruce Lee movies and slasher movies like The Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Halloween and stuff, like right outside of my window every night.
So you could literally see it outside your window.
Every night, so I would watch the films and without the sound. That and kind of reading a lot of comic books helped formulate my visual acumen. This is a time in the early 70s, late 70s, early 80s where like there was a kind of a new renaissance in filmmaking and stuff, but not for somebody like me from my background. You know, I didn't have access to a Super 8 camera or anything. I didn't know anything about that. So I used to try to draw animated films in notepads. I make little adventures with my comic book heroes and Daredevil and Iron Fist and Luke Cage and stuff. And then I started getting smart. I got my homeboys who do know how to draw every panel, and we'd make these little movies. We call them flip books. And I wished I had this thing. My friend, a real skinny, fair-skinned kid, and I still know him. And I remember in sixth grade, when we graduated from sixth grade, he wrote, you know how you have those graduation books where everybody writes something, everybody, he said to a great friend and good movie maker. But that's how I think I started with films and filmmaking. And then I started discovering, like, I think I saw a 2020 special on the making of Close Encounters with Steven Spielberg, and I saw Steven Spielberg directing, and I said, I want to do that, what that guy does. Mm-hmm. You know, but there was really no historical precedent for, like I said, a guy like me doing it. And but still, I was like, oh, that's what I want to do, you know?
Well, so you get out of high school and you apply to USC?
Yeah, I mean, but even before I got out of high school, I was on a journey to go to USC. I was like, this is where I have to go to school. I read Dale Pollack's book, Skywalking, The Life and Times of George Lucas. Right. I think I read that when I was 15 years old, and it was talking about Lucas's journey, you know, from Modesto to USC and stuff. And I was like, that's what I got to do. I got to go there. My goal was try to go from college to the professional field the way that first-round draft pick would do it in NFL or the NBA. I want to get out of school and direct my first film.
There's 2,000 people in the program. I mean, they're all wanting that. So.
And that's what they told everybody. I said, I'm going to be that one that does it. That's what I said. I said, watch. And I did it. I mean, like, I had that attitude from 18 years old. I mean, like I said, I'm going to do it. I mean, 3 weeks before I started school, I saw She's Gotta Have It in Santa Monica, and I ran into Spike Lee. You know, it was his first movie, and I was going to meet him before I graduated high school in February or March of that thing, just before he went to the San Francisco Film Festival with that film. But my mother wouldn't let me use the car because she said, oh, this has nudity in it. I'm not going to condone that.
You find She'd a way never been up to your room to see what you were watching every night, right?
No. And so I saw him before the movie started, and I said, hey, did a little name dropping. I said, hey, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing the movie. Yada, yada. He was cool with me. I go on the movie, see the movie, and I'm like, whoa, you know, I'm excited, you know. And I had seen the previews of the movie because I had just started going to what's known as revival theaters. They don't have very much of them anymore where they show old films. The first time I ever went to a revival theater, I was bored, and I said, there's nothing to do. My mother said, go to that old theater, go see some movies. I said, fine. So I saw Woody Allen's Bananas and Annie Hall. Changed my life. Then they had this thing called the Midnight Movie. I went a couple weeks later with some friends of mine and saw A Clockwork Orange. And I was like, you know what I mean? So, you know, I started really going to the films I thought I should go see. You know what I mean? Because I was really in the commercial fair, you know, really. And so I went and saw Kurosawa's Ron. And then before Ron, there was a preview before She Gotta Have It. So I knew it was coming. But I didn't know Spike was going to be there. To make a long story short, I see the movie. I come out, and he's surrounded by all these Hollywood types, and they're all over him trying to invite him up to Hills for a party. And he saw me there, and he said, excuse me. And he moved everybody out the way. And he said, what'd you think? And I just said, I'm on it. I said, these some real black folks in a movie. This is good. I said, you know what else? I'm going to USC in 2 weeks. Watch out for me. I'm coming. And so we always share that story. When he speaks, he says that, and I'm like, yo, so my whole thing with going to film school was to just explore and try to find an identity and what I wanted to do as a filmmaker and just really learn and make something of the program. And the thing I've chiefly learned that most of the young filmmakers should be learning or concentrating on is it's all about having that original concept and a genuine concept of where you're from. Your perspective and your POV, it may not be for everybody, but it's your perspective and it's valid. Even if it's just you, there's people out there that want to see what you have to say. It's like when you're making a film, it's like you're having a conversation with people. And if you do that very, very well, it will propagate in some way.
You uniquely figured out, okay, everybody wants to direct. You directed two 8mm, 8-minute films, but you'd been doing a lot of studying of film, you know, going to these retrospectives and revival houses, but also the way you got going was writing a script. But so then some, I can't remember her name, but there was a woman.
Stephanie Elaine.
Right. And she became executive producer on some of your films down the road, didn't she? Or,
yes.
She said, okay, let me see your scripts. And Boys in the Hood went to, was it Frank Price eventually?
Well, yeah, it was initially, it was Russell Simmons who read it.
Oh, right.
And then when Russell got excited about it, Stephanie had gotten informed about it. And so it's like, see, I told you this is this guy, you know, we got to find a way to get this movie made. But to her credit, she did what executives in this business would never do. She put everything online. She did everything but jump on the table. Like, this is a movie that we're here for. This is the kind of movie we should be making.
And I've forgotten, so Russell was, he had a deal cooking with Columbia?
He was going to have a deal, and he cursed out the head of the studio, and he, and so he didn't get the deal, and they gave me the deal.
Okay.
That's what happened. That's true.
That's how it works out.
Yeah.
But and then the next piece of that, too, was, okay, we've got this really cool script, so we're going to cut a deal, we're going to cut you a check, and you said, no, I'm going to direct.
No, they were testing me. They were saying, you know, hey, what if we tell you we want to buy your script and get somebody else to direct it? And I said, well, we have to end this meeting right now. And they're like, oh, you know. And I said, well, because I'm going to direct this movie. And I, you know, the whole idea was like, I got to act like, you know, nobody wants to give you nothing if you act like you really need it. So you got to be like, you know, part of that is a little hustle. It's like, okay, well, fine, bye. I wanted to do it my way.
Right. But again, you got there through having the goods on the page.
So. Yes. I always feel like the cheapest way to make a movie is to write it. The hardest thing to do besides write a great screenplay, which is a hard mountain, it's like climbing Everest, is to write a great screenplay. The next mountain to climb is to get somebody to actually read your thing. And to get somebody to read your thing that can actually take the energy enough to make a phone call. You know what? This is something that we should try to consider.
Well, I know you've had a significant number of influences, and even today you're talking about more, but there's one influence, August Wilson. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. He did write one film, The Piano Lesson.
Yeah,
but
he was a friend of mine, too.
Yeah, that's awesome. So please tell us a little bit about that inspiration, because it's important.
Ironically, August is the reason that I became a writer. When I was a sophomore at USC, it was right after The Fences had just got all of its Tonys. When James Earl Jones won the Tony, it got Best Play. It won all the awards back east. So then they brought the production west, and James and Courtney B. Vance, who I just directed in recently now in the O.J. Trial, who's playing Johnny Cochran, they all performed, and my mother got me a ticket to it, and I saw it. That's when I really started writing, and I realized that I could have an impact. And one thing I learned from August's work, especially the early plays, was how poetically Negroid they were. There was a certain language that black people had that were unique to us. It was something that could be felt and intellectualized. You know, there's a line in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom where a character says, I may be a fool, but I ain't the same fool twice. That's when you and I part ways. And then the way he would roll stuff out of a tongue. So I was like, wow. It was great in the literary tradition, but when you saw an actor do it, and an actor who had that rhythm and soul perform it, it came off differently. And then, so that's what I want. I want to be able to say stuff without saying it.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International. We'll be back in a moment. This is On Story from Austin Film Festival and PRI. I'm your host, Barbara Morgan. We're back with filmmaker John Singleton speaking with Fred Stripe at the Austin Film Festival in 2015.
Before I did Boys in the Hood, as I was in pre-production, I was taking acting classes right across from where the production office was. And I was acting as though I was just some guy that wanted to be an actor. I'm telling them all, hey, I work at UPS, and you know,
this is your acting friends you're telling at the school
class.
The class, yeah.
I really want to be an actor. I think I could do something really special and stuff. Mind you, I just come from the office where I'm like talking to the DP, talking to everybody, and we're casting Boys in the Hood like one building over. And then this one guy comes who was in my acting class one day. He comes to read for a part in Boys in the Hood, and he sees me in the office and says, oh, you working on this? I said, yeah, man, I kind of got a job over here. And he said, man, what you doing? I said, well, I'll talk to you about it later, man. I can't talk about it right now. They got me doing something, right?
I think you said you're working behind the camera.
Yeah, I'm working behind the camera. So then he comes up to read, and they said, this is Jackie Brown, the casting person. This is Steve Nicolaitis, the producer. And this is director John Singleton. He goes... And he really, that just threw him totally off. That threw his audition totally off.
So you were blown. There was no way you're going back to class. They didn't know you weren't directing.
I still went back to class, but they, you know, like, and then I hired the woman that was my acting teacher. I hired her to be a coach for Cube and for Morris Chestnut and some of the people that, most of the people, that was their first movie. I would just tell my friends, hey, I want you to be in my movie. Even the casting director said, John, you can't put all your feelings in your movie. I said, I'm the director. I can do whatever I want to do.
Speaking about acting a little bit more, you've broken in more first-time actors. They may have had other careers, particularly in rap and hip-hop, but you've brought people to the screen, and not just done that, but done it. They've given these extraordinary performances. Mm-hmm. And so what's the secret? Is it alchemy between your screenwriting so they understand what you want and then how you communicate with them?
It's the material, and it's the people... And it's me and them in our relationship, because just like I said with Jackie, I'm basically working with my friends. I'm working with people that I knew, you know what I mean? They feel comfortable, you know, they just want to do for the project for me. You know, good examples as Baby Boy, only Tyrese and Taraji were supposed to have like love scenes and have nudity clauses in it. But as we got into it, everybody wanted to take the clothes off.
Very relaxed.
Yeah, everybody's like, God, I feel free. I just want to, you know, there's a funny story where they have this love scene, and Tyrese is all nervous about getting in bed and showing his body and stuff, and Taraji is just like, everything is out. Everything. Just, and he's all shy. I don't know about this. And I'm like, you're going to sell more albums. Ain't nobody worried about this but you. And Taraji, if you know her, she says, get your in this bed. You're going to my first love scene. I got worked up for this. Get your in this bed now.
And that's a relaxed.
And we're playing R. Kelly and stuff. And then Ving, it's like the scene that he does in the kitchen with the Kool-Aid and everything like this. After he does the scene, we're in the middle of the neighborhood, right? And he walks out in his robe in the front of the house in the hood, and all the girls like, ooh, da 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 da. He drops his robe and walks butt naked in the whole damn neighborhood to his trailer. And all the women are like, oh my God, I can't do this. People are like, thank God they didn't have camera phones back then. It would have been Instagrammed everywhere. And the irony is that, you know, Tyrese was never an original person. That was supposed to be Tupac. And the last time we actually talked, I was like, got the movie that's going to get you an Oscar. It was like, he was supposed to be Jody. As good as Tyrese is in the movie, and he's my friend and baby brother. Every time I watch a movie, I'm like, if Pac would have played this part, I've been blazing.
Was the experience in the industry, did it mirror sort of what your experience would be in L.A., where you're kind of an outsider trying to get in, having to advocate for yourself?
Oh, very much so. But the irony of it is that once I made my movie and my splash with that movie, I was welcome in open arms within the business.
But then Spike's letter to you in Poetic Justice, it does say, be careful for that second or third film because...
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, you know, they took after me on Poetic Justice, you know, whatever, because I had so much accolades on the first movie. But I knew that was going to happen. You know, the movie opened $13 million. It's like, it opened more than it cost, you know, so I knew that I had to to kind of like mitigate whatever was going to come at me. And I always felt that even though, hey, it's a great movie, Boys is a great movie, you know, it spoke to something that it was already in the zeitgeist but hadn't been seen cinematically. And over time, it's even more propagated and become even more important. You know, it begot, you know, even Straight Outta Compton now, you know, this year. But I feel that a lot of the press that I got was in backlash to how certain people felt about Spike at the time, because he was the only person out there saying, Hollywood is f***ed up, you don't hire enough black people, you don't get credit to enough black artists or any people of color. And let's like take black people out of the equation. Before, we were protesting the Oscars and all this stuff, you look at a movie like The Last Emperor, which is one of my favorite movies. Yeah. All these Oscar nominations and no acting nominations.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
John Lone, John Chen, you know what I mean? Like, none. And he got like 10 or 12 Oscar nominations and none for the acting. So he was the only person out there kicking dust. And then I come along and I said, well, you know, here.
I know. I also felt that you had the sensibility of an independent filmmaker. You're going to make it.
Yeah.
But then you kicked in the front door and got in. And so I can see what you're talking about, this backlash. Well, okay, we got one in, so just forget about
it. Yeah, it's like more of a kind of a tokenism. Like, okay, we did something right. But it wasn't like, you know, like, okay, well, you got this guy and there's some other people in it. You know, I felt that what I was doing was kind of like what certain people at my peers at the time that I looked up to, like, you know, people like Gus Van Sant. You know what I mean? Like, when I was about to prep Boys in the Hood, I would watch Drugstore Cowboy over and over and over again. You know what I'm saying? Because I liked what Gus was doing. I had never thought I was going to be a studio filmmaker. I always planned on being an independent filmmaker.
Right.
So then once I got a chance to do some studio films, and you have an ebb and a tide and weight of that where you're a studio filmmaker and whatever, it wasn't so much of a thing for me to say, you know what, when they said, well, we don't want to make this thing with you because it's too wild and crazy. I said, okay, fine, I'll go do it on my own. And then I made Hustle and Flow.
Right.
I produced it. You know what I mean? There's so many great, great things that would have never come if someone had said, well, I don't know if I should tell this story because it's not going to identify, nobody's going to identify with it and everything, right? You know, you look at a great movie, Ben Zeichen did Beasts of the Southern Wild. That movie could never have been made in the system, but he just had a vision for what he wanted to do. Right. You know what I mean? And he did it. And he made it kind of homegrown. He shot it over a period of time, and it just, you know, it's a poem.
It is, yeah. What was it like to mentor people and then they go off and do things and do they come back? Or
it feels good. Not everybody has to come back. Just do your own thing. I mean, there's a kid that I met when he was 16 years old that I got him into USC, who's from the jungles right down the street from my house and my office. I got him to USC and all he had to do was go for 1 year in junior college and he couldn't do that. So then he did some other stuff and whatever this and he went to Acton Conservatory for a second, got kicked out of Acton Conservatory. He wanted to be a director. He came up to me. He said, I'm going to be the next you. I said, no, you ain't going to be next me. This is what you got to do. He's now 23 years old, and he's been acting. He's been directing and all this stuff. And he's the second lead on my TV show right now.
Really?
So he's acting, but he's also with me, like, learning how to direct. After a certain while, you know, he is able to click in to exactly what I was trying to tell him all these years. Sometimes people come back, and sometimes people don't. That's just life. I mean, I think it's harder for me to tell my kids what to do. And I have two of them in film school, and everyone else wants to know my advice. My kids say, you know, okay. I don't know nothing. You know what I'm saying?
That's being a father, right?
I know. I had no experience before I did Boys in the Hood. My process was to read the biography of a very interesting filmmaker, then watch their pictures. You know, I could take someone like Alfred Hitchcock and then watch his pictures. You know, I read a bio of Fritz Lang. You know what I mean? What made Fritz Lang so unique when he was making those new movies in Germany? And then watch his German films and then watch his American films, right? That was before I got a chance to actually have the equipment. So then when I get the equipment, I'm like, okay, I'm just going and interpreting. And then as I started exploring this field and talking to other filmmakers like Francis Coppola and different people around, I was like, yo, if you're going to steal from the best, and you see like Martin Scorsese's work, who's a brilliant filmmaker, right? A lot of what Marty Scorsese did in his early work and some of his later work is all from great filmmakers. He pulls from Fellini, he pulls from other Italian filmmakers from the neorealist period and stuff, right? That shot that he does, the tracking shot that everybody loves, we have everybody in the foreground and background and everything like this, that's straight out of Fellini. But even Fellini, I feel Fellini was doing that in the tradition of the big Italian frescoes. So Fellini's doing something that is maybe 500 years old. And then Marty looks at it and he makes it his own. For me, it's like, it's recreating spontaneity. You know, whenever you put the camera on, it's not life, it's a reflection of life, but you have to recreate spontaneity. You've had to have seen Taxi Driver. But if you've only seen Taxi Driver once, twice, three times, you haven't seen it enough. If you watch that movie is like, it's a mixture of stark reality and dream reality.
Yeah.
And that's why it works. That's what I'm always like trying to go after, like, okay, yes, I can do something very, very hard, realistic, and all that stuff, but can I do something that, you know, that can only be told in a cinematic way that will, after people see the experience, they want to see it again and again and again, not necessarily because it makes them feel good, mm-hmm. but because it brought something out them emotionally. It mm-hmm. brought something out to you emotionally that you're like, why am I feeling this way? Let me go back and watch it. You know what I mean? And so that's what I feel I'm going for as an artist.
Well, I know you're going to be teaching at USC for the first time, I guess, this coming fall. Is that
in a
right?
long time, yeah. The course that I'm teaching is called Emergence of Multiethnic Cinema, and it talks about how the breakdown in the last 100 years from a manifest destiny attitude of white male-dominated cinema to more of a multiethnic point of view of cinema now that is now the commercial idiom. And it starts with John Ford in 1962 with Sergeant Rutledge, where Woody Strobe, he was the black dude that got killed in Spartacus. John Ford put the camera on him and made him a buffalo soldier. And he's like larger than life. Mm-hmm. So he shot Woody Strobe the way that he shot John Wayne. Mm-hmm. The first time a black man had ever been shot like that. Wow. And you watch it, and you're like, whoa. Mm-hmm. This is about 9 years before Shaft. So I showed that kind of movie, and I showed Blazing Saddles. Because Blazing Saddles was written by Mel Brooks and some of his former writers from Your Show of Shows, mm-hmm. and Richard Pryor was in the room. You watch that picture, and you see how the relationship between Cleavon Little and Gene Wilder, and the stuff that they talk about innocuously is funny, but it breaks down so many different barriers, and it becomes a conversation thing, you know what I'm saying? Right. And so, like, I go through this all this thing all the way up to 48 hours, and all that stuff with Nick Lotti and Eddie Murphy, where he goes on the thing and says, you know, hey, I don't like white people, so y'all know I'm enjoying this. And Nick Nolte said, you know, hey, I'm sorry about that spear chucker, you know, kind of business, you know? I mean, it's like humor, right. but also in a genre movie, you know what
right.
I mean? You get to, like, Pulp Fiction. You know, Quentin was the first modern filmmaker to actually make a multi-ethnic movie where everybody was cool. Mm-hmm. Usually it was just the white guy was cool and everybody of color was just like whack and they got killed.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Sam Jackson doesn't die in Pulp Fiction. It's about the breakdown of what I call the manifest destiny of cinema. All the way back to the silent age. If you didn't have Sidney Poitier in The Heat of the Night with Rob Starger, you wouldn't have Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte
right.
in 48 Hours. So there's a kind of a lineage, you know, showing that stuff. If you didn't have Gordon Parks directing Shaft, I dare to say you wouldn't have Denzel Washington. I have this show, and it's going to be a monster. It's called Snowfall. And we just finished shooting it last week. It's L.A., 1982. It's how cocaine changed L.A. Some good stuff in it, man, and everybody is represented in a different way, but it's not didactic, you know, it's like really like cool, you know what I mean? It's representative, it's kind of like a culmination of everything that I've done is going right into this show. So it's got drama, humor, action, my friends in it, you know what I mean? I think we're going to really excite people and put something in the landscape of television that has never been seen before, because it's like making little movies. We're making a movie, you know, every few weeks. It's a really fun period. It's something that's come, I haven't been able to explore this before. Mm-hmm. My formative years were the 80s, and a lot of the movies that I really like were from the 80s. You know, some of them are throwaway pictures and stuff, but, you know, a lot of them are action and genre films and stuff like that. And the reason it's called Snowfall is because it's all about cocaine, but then you know that once the price of cocaine goes down, there's something called crack coming. And when it comes, it's going to be... You know, it's going to be a storm. So it's like, everybody thinks it's a crack show. They're like, oh, he's doing The Wire. It's like, I don't copy nobody. People copy me. Like,
Charles Burnett's most notable works include the films Killer of Sheep, My Brother's Wedding, and To Sleep with Anger. Killer of Sheep was Charles Burnett's master's thesis at UCLA and was included among the first 50 films entered in the National Film Registry for its historical importance by the Library of Congress in 1990. Charles Burnett has received numerous awards for his contribution to American cinema, including a Guggenheim Fellowship and Howard University's Paul Robeson Award. Michael McCambridge spoke with Charles Burnett at the Austin Film Festival in 2015.
Charles Burnett has been called the most gifted, important black filmmaker this country has ever had. The writer Armand White said that he is the least well-known great American filmmaker. Finally, Michael Tolkien said about his film Killer of Sheep, "Were it an Italian film from 1953, we would have every scene memorized." Belatedly, Killer of Sheep did get its moment in the sun, included in the National Film Registry of Classic Films. You said you moved from Mississippi to California when you were very young, around 1949, 1950. It was more rural than we could even imagine now, and it did have a southern sensibility. You talked a little bit about that.
Well, I grew up in South Central, and beyond that, it was sort of undeveloped to a large extent. We had chickens and turkeys and all sorts of things, rabbits and so forth, because my family, my grandmother had all those things in the South, and you can certainly have them there, you know. In fact, later on, my brother had a horse, and he kept it, you know, a couple of miles down, you know, but like out near Compton, you know. Right. And as a kid, we used to go out with these bow and arrows, you know. There were swamps and things out, and we would go, I guess we'd call it hunting, but it was nothing to really hunt, you know, but we'd have these, you know, things, and, you know, and there was another place called Motorcycle Hill or Devil's Dip that it was full of mountains or high hills, and in the valleys of them, it would flood, you know, and the water would be over your head. And we used to go swimming in that. And I couldn't swim. I thought, man, I could have drowned, you know. You know, it was really like Tom Sawyer. It was really adventuresome, you know. And that was one of the problems. I spent more time running around and discovering things rather than studying, you know, because we were, as kids, always on our bikes going everywhere. We really explored Los Angeles, you know, the undeveloped part of L.A.
So you grow up in this socially convulsive time, LA in the 60s. What led you to film school? Obviously, you had an experience with electrician school, right?
Yeah.
And then after that, you wound up going to UCLA. Tell us about that journey.
Getting into UCLA was interesting because USC is closest to where I live. And so I thought I'd go there first, you know. But it was a private school, very expensive, you know. So I went there and applied, and I thought I can get a loan there, and they said, well, yeah, but you have to enroll first to apply for a loan, but then you have to pay the initial tuition. Yeah, I said, but I have to get the loan first before I can get enroll, you know, and it looked like it was a catch-22. No, you have to. It's like in the film business, you know, where in order to get a job as an actor, whatever it is, you have to be in the Screen Actors Guild. You know, in order to get in the Screen Actors Guild, you have to have had someone give you the opportunity to work in a film. So, you know, I called up UCLA. It was in the 60s, so I called up UCLA. And, you know, it was sort of an informal kind of atmosphere, which is really great. And they said, yeah, come on over, you know.
On Story from Austin Film Festival and Public Radio International, we'll be back in a moment.
Thank you.
We're back with filmmaker Charles Burnett speaking with Michael McCambridge at the Austin Film Festival in 2015. Before the break, Charles Burnett was discussing his childhood in what was then rural Compton, just south of Los Angeles, in the early 1950s, and his decision to attend film school. We pick up with Charles Burnett describing experiences as a UCLA film student under the tutelage of British documentarian Basil Wright.
In general, UCLA was known to be sort of anti-Hollywood. If you wanted to go into Hollywood, you went to USC, you know, and there was a big difference between the two schools. And one of the great things about UCLA was that, you know, they gave you a camera and Project One and said, go out and make a film. And the idea was to come back with something we haven't seen before. Because if you came back with anything that resembled something that they've seen, cliched or whatever, that you were crucified at the end of the quarter screenings. I mean, literally crucified by teachers and students, right. You know. It was very vengeful. So you were, when you made a film, you're very guarded, you know. Really, people were, if you went to talk to a student, if he was working this film, he'd put his, he would cover his work, you know, and look at you like you're trying to steal his gold or something, you know, like they're miners. And so it was that kind of competition, you know. But they allowed you to do whatever you wanted to do. You know, basically, if you wanted to be a cameraman or worked on sound editing, you were able to do that. Where at SC, it was very structured where you had to do one of, you know, either camera or sound, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And they only selected certain people to direct, whereas UCLA, you do whatever you want. And everyone can do anything. I mean, a lot of people don't want to be directors or anything, but they chose. They were able to sort of evolve into sort of filmmakers they wanted to. And that was a great thing. Independently, it really helps to know all those things, you know, that worked in all those job areas, you know.
Right. Okay, so you sit down in front of the typewriter in 1969 to write the screenplay from which your first film, Several Friends, would be made. Tell us about the inspiration for that, and because that was really your first screenplay of note, right?
Yes. Well, you know, I was lucky to take Basil Wright as a documentary teacher. You know, he taught there for a while. And when I got there, I didn't know what I wanted to do, you know, because it was a time when they had hippies and flower children and all that sort of thing like that. And they're making these films that were, you know, people were expressing their sexual freedom and all this kind of stuff, you know, and literally fluttering to the through the grassy fields and stuff. And so I was sitting there and said, I can't do this. You know, I can't, that's not my reality. And luckily for Basil Wright, I was taking this class because I just, you know, just went to him one day and expressed the problems I had, you know. I can't do this, you know. And you know, he had did song with Cicillon and things like that, you know, and worked with Gerson and things like that, on Night Mail and all of that. And so he just said, you know, don't worry, make your film and remember to respect the subject, you know. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, that sort of, the light came on, you know, and I said, well, yeah. But because the whole reason I went to film, it reminded me of to do films about my community, you know, and using film as a means for social change. And also, I was doing work with this political group of filmmakers who were making films about, you know, the working class and exploitation and stuff like that, you know, and it was a sort of a formulaic kind of a situation where the plot was always the same, the characters always ended up, you know, forming a union and everything was happy after that, you know. And even though they were progressive and had good intentions, you know, it was the same story, you know. If you just applied this formula, then you're okay. But I came from a situation where it didn't work for a lot of people. Were happy to get a job, but all these other issues were impacting them, you know. And so if you're going to make a film of social change, you have to show the sort of dynamics of the universities people come from, you know. I remember how I came to that was, you know, I used to go to this barbershop in Watts, you know, and I thought everybody there was open to revolution and all this kind of stuff, you know. And I was an admirer of Paul Robeson. And it was Paul Robeson's birthday or something coming up, you know. So I go to this barbershop all the time. There are these two old guys, you know, who've been to the South and been in the Army and all this kind of stuff. They're very smart guys. And so I went in there and I was like, oh man, Paul Robeson's birthday is, you know, coming up and we should do this and that. And they looked at me and I mean, it was like, you know, they just said the total opposite. They said, you know, in a sense that, you know, they liked him as an artist, but for a person, that he shouldn't have really spoke out against his country and all that sort of thing. I'm looking at these guys, I'm saying, if you of all people talking about, you know, you're from the South and everything like that, and you're talking about. And so we got in this big argument, and so they said, I'll get you a ticket to Russia if you promise not to come back. <You know? laughs> And I was like, I realized then that I was going in another direction because I had, you know, been a couple of years in school at UCLA at the time. And then when I wanted to make a film about the community, I realized I had to step back, and I couldn't prescribe things that had, you know, only, you know, my ideas and things like that wouldn't apply. Mm-hmm. And so I was very careful about plotting a situation where, you know, some predictable kind of a thing where you say like ABC and this would happen as a consequence, because it didn't happen like that in my environment. The idea was to demystify filmmaking in the community, mm-hmm. you know, and expose kids to it, you know, because, you know, when I did Killer Sheep, they were working on the sound and all that stuff like that. I mean, it wasn't a very good idea to have sometimes kids working when you really need a professional to do this stuff, you know, because it comes back to haunt you later on, you know, when you want to do timing and mixing and stuff like that. But the idea, too, was we never were thinking about making a living off of this stuff. So it really didn't matter the end result to some extent, you know, how perfect it was or imperfect. You know, at that time, it was very difficult for anyone to get in the business.
Oh, yeah.
And for a person of color, it was impossible. And this, you know, usually the route in was you have an uncle or brother or something like that, or a cousin or someone in the business. Then, you know, you have a chance. And then even that, if you'd be a cameraman, you had to wait like 10 years or something like that to get, you know, just to be a loader, you know. Mm-hmm. So we just... It was never part of my concern or reality to think that, oh, I'm going to be doing this. I thought it would be a hobby or something.
So early 70s, you start working on your thesis, mm-hmm. which becomes the film Killer of Sheep. I think it's worth a reminder at this time that to the extent that blacks were portrayed in mainstream cinema at all then, mm-hmm. it was through what we know today as blaxploitation mm-hmm. films. You couldn't have set a motion picture depicting African Americans in the United States that was more than 180 degrees mm. from, say, Shaft mm. than Killer of Sheep. Mm. Tell me how that idea came to you and how you began assembling that as your thesis. And in fact, why you chose a dramatic film rather than, say, a documentary, given Basil Wright's tremendous influence on you.
Well, I thought it'd be easier to tell a narrative in a certain way, but in a way where it looked like it was something I just captured offhand, in a sense. But like I was saying, everything up to that point led to that, you know. I knew that being at UCLA, that my whole thinking was different, you know, then that was something I always kept in mind. If I had got in an argument with someone about, was this representative, you know, I would always point out the fact that I've seen this happen in the community. I got that from the community, these events, and I put them in a narrative to try to make sense out of them was the whole idea. So, I mean, there's some things in there that are questionable, you know, but still, you know, people playing dice and stuff like that, but that happened. Yeah, that's part of life there, you know, so I couldn't avoid it, you know. So I didn't want to make a, you know, romanticized version of it, or, you know, or one that's politically correct, so to speak, kind of view of the community, one that sort of represented sort of a wide range of experience, you know. Because if you're talking about creating a program or something that was supposed to educate other people on how to correct certain issues in the community, then you have to present it as the complicated responsible. So if you show the film, because this idea was to show it in the community and show it to people who are supposed to have means of solving these problems. Now, this is what it looks like. Now, how can you approach this problem? Now, education is one, yeah, and there's all these other issues you have to deal with. You know, it's not just one thing. And so it was up to the audience and people to decide what solutions can we gain from looking at this film.
If it was just the subject matter, if that was all, that would have been innovative and illuminating in itself. But there was also this powerfully veristic, observational style of filmmaking that you brought to it. I want to read a review of the film, Killer of Sheep, by Roger Ebert. He said, "You have to be prepared to see a film like this, or able to relax and allow it to unfold. It doesn't come, as most films do, with built-in instructions about how to view it. One scene follows another with no apparent pattern, reflecting how the lives of its family combine endless routine with the interruptions of random events. the day they all pile into a car to go to the races, for example, a lesser film would have them winning or losing. In this film, they have a flat tire and no spare. Thus does poverty become your companion on every journey. Mm. Did you know while you were shooting the film that the style in which you were making it was such a departure from mainstream cinema that we had seen at that time? And was that conscious, or was that just your own style expressing itself?
No, it was conscious, because we were in a group that was opposed to, you know, the conventional way of telling the story, particularly how they represent people of color in stories, you know. And so everything you did was reaction toward the establishment, you know, what we were used to seeing, and trying to get at what represented this kind of work and exposure. So it was always, we had constant arguments and debates about, like, are you a black filmmaker, and whatever it is, and you're not representing, you know. And it was incumbent upon us, because it was during that whole civil rights movement thing, you know. If you had a chance, you know, to say something, and you realize, I can't speak for anyone but myself, you know, at a certain point, you know, because everyone, it's so varied, you know. Like I was saying, when I was at the barbershop, I couldn't speak for these guys, you know, because they wanted to send me out of the country, you know, and all of that, so. It just represents a slice of life, my friends that I grew up with. I can say for sure what happened with them. I was mainly interested in themes more than, you know, resolutions, that in order to survive, you have to have this and that, and a sense of responsibility and principle. Not that that's the only way to survive, but the people I respect were working people no matter what, you know, and they weren't getting credit for it.
Right. So Killer of Sheep is about 5 years in the making, from beginning it to when you first screened it at Howard, you said.
It really didn't take that long to make it, because we shot on the weekends, of course, so when people, they weren't really actors, they didn't have the sort of idea what it takes to be an actor, and because we were starred, and they were friends of mine, and so, like, if a person couldn't come that day, he'd say, we had already shot some footage on him and things like that, and he was in a scene, and he would say, well, can't so-and-so take my place? And you say, no, it's not like playing football where you can change a quarterback in the middle of a play. But the thing about it is, I give them credit, because their weekends were precious to them, you know. They didn't know what it would take, you know. And so there are times when they didn't show up, whatever it is, and act like, well, like, what's the problem? What's the, you know? And it's like, it's a big problem when you don't show up. But you have to live with that, you know. So that's why we only had, like, kids working on the film, basically, because, you know, regular guys would give up. And,
you know, obviously Killer of Sheep is this seminal film, but it's up till 1990 before you get, like, broad exposure with To Sleep With Anger. I sometimes wonder about that whole period of the 80s, if you were sort of in the wasteland. What was your experience then of your art?
When the Europeans decided or were looking for different programming, and the festivals like Berlin and Paris and places like that. In fact, Killer Sheep won an award there. It was surprising, because it was in all the papers in Germany and in parts of Europe and things like that, you know. The thing was, when I got back here, there was nothing silent, you know. But it was through there that I got money from German television to do my brother's wedding. Mm-hmm. And so it was really a pleasant surprise. And many of the filmmakers who went there was, like, really shocked, because it sort of validated, you know, what we were doing and things like that. It was like, we felt as though it was the same period in the 30s where jazz was featured there, and you know, and people were writing about it and things like that, you know. And here was a case where the first critical analysis or response to it was in Europe. Mm-hmm. And so at that point, we sort of felt, yeah, well, we are filmmakers or something, you know, and I can make a film, you know.
I was on the film desk at the American Statesman in 1990 when To Sleep With Anger came out, and it was, I can remember reading the other stories at that time, it was sort of, okay, Charles Burnett, is he ready for his close-up now, you know, he's doing a much bigger film, much bigger cast. What was the most difficult adjustment to filmmaking at that scale compared to where you had been with Killer of Sheep and My Brother's Wedding?
It was a learning experience. I had to learn quick on my feet, because I was working with some really great actors and things, you know. And I must say they were very kind, you know, in many ways. When you're working with non-actors, they're playing themselves in many ways, you know, you sort of typecast. And on one hand, the characters are not new to them. But in terms of working with real actors, You know, they come from different experiences. They're I guess, mostly middle class or something like that, you know, and a whole different take on life and reality. You know, I remember Mary Alice was this great actress, you know. There was a scene in the kitchen, and so she came in and she says, "Where am I coming from in this scene?" And I'm like, "Just come in at the door," kind of thing. "What do you need? What do you need to have this stuff in the background?" I didn't say that, luckily. I've been looking like an idiot, you know. And I'm like standing there and trying to figure out something to say. You know? Coming from the other room and something else and then cooking, whatever. I was able to disguise my ignorance very well. But anyway, one of the good things was working with actors who can give you things like that, you know. Mm-hmm. And they knew that, you know, time-wise and everything, that to be at a certain point and everything. And they were very enthusiastic about, you know, doing what they were doing, you know. And so all of that was good. I was in Algeria working on the film. Then I was in Namibia working on the film. One of the things I knew I needed to do was tell their story and listen to them. It's not about me. It's about you. And so I did a lot of research and study and listen to people and things like that. It's sort of comical in a way because, you know, this business is that you have to worry about time all the time, you know. And when you work with actors, you want them to hurry up, you know, because for a number of reasons, for editing and also because the cost of being on the set for whatever. But we're in Africa, and one of the characters, main character, goes home and he learns that his aunt has died. And so how they do it there is when they want to tell you something, they go in a roundabout way, a long story, but, oh, you know, your aunt was, you know, a really wonderful person, and she did that, she did this, and as a child, she did, well, on and on. And without saying to the person, you know, your aunt died, you know, whatever. And so you're waiting there, and so it goes on for a good while. And you know that that's not going to be in the shot, you know, and editing is going to be... And so you say, well, can you make that shorter? And the guy says, well, we can't, because we don't do that. Like, we don't... In the same way, when I was shooting the film here in Texas, I think it was, there was this Vietnamese area that we were shooting at. You dream of cutting the film a certain way, and so you have these actors walk a certain way or walk into the shot, and so we're trying to find some for this Vietnamese or Laotian, I can't remember which now, and I said, why don't we have you in the garden doing this or something like that? It'd be a nice, you know, thing to see you in the garden. And so he had this sort of strange look on his face. And so I said, well, is there something wrong? He says, well, men don't do that, you know. And I said, okay, well, you do what you do. You know, you do what men do, you know. I mean, you have to be sensitive enough to understand the culture as much as you can and all the gestures and nuances. It's really not about you.
On Story is brought to you in part by the Alice Kleberg Reynolds Foundation, a Texas family providing innovative funding since 1979. This project is supported in part by the Cultural Arts Division of the City of Austin Economic Development Department, the Texas Commission on the Arts, the U.S. Institute of Museum and Library Services, and Texas Library and Archives Commission. This program is also made possible in part by a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate for the National Endowment for the Humanities. The show is produced by myself, Barbara Morgan. Our associate producers are Colin Heyer, Sonia McCarter, Bita Gassemi, and Maya Perez. Our audio is recorded by Travis Kennedy, and our editor is Jamal Knox. Music by Brian Ramos. Production assistance comes from the Sound Lab, Inc. and KUT 90.5 in Austin. To find out more about On Story and Austin Film Festival, visit onstory.tv or austinfilmfestival.com. Until next time, I'm Barbara Morgan, and this has been Austin Film Festival's On Story.
PRI, Public Radio International.